Welcome. My role now is to introduce Anne Lismore, who will in turn introduce Sami Khoury. I'm glad that Anne is here because Anne is very relevant when it comes to Sweden and the Middle East. She's still a diplomat, she's still with the Foreign Office and has an interesting task there for the moment, connected very much to what we are going to discuss tonight. She was also the director of UNRWA in Beirut. UNRWA is, as you know, the Palestinian, the United Nations Agency for Support to the Palestinians and Palestinian refugees. A very, very difficult job, of course, not least in the present situation. She came back 2 years ago?
6 months ago.
6 months ago, so she has fresh impressions. And I know that she knows Rami, so it's a good one to introduce him. So over to you, Anne.
Thank you very much, and good evening, everyone. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Rami Khoury, such a well-known and well-respected columnist, public speaker, and researcher, who has been following events in the Middle East for more than 40 years and on a first-hand basis. And he's also a very familiar face to all of us who are following the news in Al Jazeera, BBC, and the CNN. And personally, I've been very, very happy to meet Rami many times over the years when I've been serving both as an ambassador in Lebanon and more recently working for the UN and UNRWA in Lebanon. And Rami, who is also very much well established in academic circles. He's a board member of East West Institute at Georgetown University, and until recently a director at the Sam Faris Institute at the American University in Beirut, AUB. And your speech here tonight, Rami, is on the perils of ISIL and its implication for the future. And ISIL is being debated extensively in Sweden, which I mentioned also the other night when we met. For example, one topic that is very much in the political debate and in the media is Swedes joining as foreign terrorist fighters, joining ISIL or other terror organizations in the Middle East or elsewhere. And today in Parliament, there was a debate on Sweden supporting the Iraqi army in its fight against ISIL by sending Swedish military advisors to Iraq. That was being debated today. And you recently wrote a very interesting article in the Lebanese Daily Star on ISIL and how to avoid ISIL becoming even more entrenched and even more popular. So we very much look forward to listening to Rami Khoury here tonight. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Anne and Thomas. Thank you all. Thank you all for being here and for the two host institutions, the Olof Palme Center and the Social Democratic Party, for arranging this, and for our dear friends Matthias and Ulrika Mossberg for being the catalyst to get this going. I can't think of two people who I would be more proud to share a stage with than Thomas and Anne, and it's a real honor for me to be here with you, and I look forward to the discussion. And of course, like everything Swedish, there's good gender balance, so I'm happy to be part of that too. So ISIS is, I use the word ISIS. I don't like to call them Islamic State, because I don't think they're really about Islam, and I don't think they have the legitimacy of a state. ISIS, ISIL, you can use any of these terms that you like. The important thing about them, I will make a few quick points, and then we'll open it up for discussion and comments and questions and answers, and I look forward to hearing your comments and questions as well. I would make a couple of quick points. The first is that ISIS is essentially an Arab problem. It's not an Islamic problem. It's not a Middle Eastern problem. And it's not really a global problem in a major way. It's mostly an Arab problem. It is the consequence of three generations of mismanagement of Arab power, sovereignty, and statehood. it is the consequence of three generations, 60, 70 years, of Arab governments running their societies quite inefficiently, quite inequitably, and reaching a point today, and in the last 20 years, really 25 years, reaching a point where a majority of Arab people, over 50% clearly of ordinary citizens across the entire Arab world, are in a state of significant vulnerability, marginalization, political disenfranchisement, environmental stress, serious problems that are closing in on citizens from every quarter of life. Well over half the people of the Arab world are living very close to, at, or below the poverty level, and surviving, but barely surviving, month to month. You have a situation where the quality of governance in the Arab world increased steadily from the 1930s till the 1980s. There was a significant nationalist development momentum in the Arab world from the 1930s till the 1980s. Most things in the Arab world were getting better year after year. Housing, schooling, healthcare, etc., jobs. In the middle of the 1980s, in the decade of the 1980s, two things happened. Population growth outstripped economic growth. Governments simply could not maintain the pace of welfare state support, subsidizing food, free education, jobs for all graduates. That was no longer possible. You had stresses in the oil, international oil market, which reduced aid flows to many Arab countries. At the end of the 80s, the Cold War ended. The American and Russian support and pressure in the region lifted. Many countries were set adrift. And most importantly of all, by the mid-1980s, a process that had started in the early 70s reached its peak, which was the complete control of all aspects of society in every Arab country, with possibly the exception of Lebanon, which is the only Arab country that did not have a strong central government that subjugated people. But Lebanon has its own problems, but it did not and does not have the problem of a central government that acts in a often brutal or hard way against its own citizens. But in every Arab country, what had happened by the mid-1980s was that control of all aspects of life, economy, information, politics, civil society, ideology, religion, was in the hands of families, a family in each country, Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, or Hafez al-Assad, Muammar Gaddafi, Ali Abdullah Saleh, Zain al-Abidin bin Ali, Abdulaziz Bouteflika. You can go over the countries and name them one by one. The families are better known than the countries in most cases. And Egypt, Hosni Mubarak, and these families were directly linked to the military and security services. So by the 1980s, the Arab world had transformed from what had been a series of national development states that were developing in a nationalist way and improving the conditions of life of most of their people, to a situation of security-run, family-anchored, militarily controlled consumer states, where there were no citizens, but they were consumers. You could buy anything you wanted in the Arab world in the 1980s and until today. You could have 6 cell phones. You could have 3 cars. But you couldn't vote in a free election. You couldn't complain in a significant way against grievances that your own government may have been responsible for. You couldn't hold accountable governments that, in some cases, in some of the most egregious cases, you would have governments in some of the wealthy oil-producing countries decide, as several did recently, to spend $60 billion or $120 billion. That's a lot of money. one person makes the decision to spend $120 billion to give money to the people, basically to keep them quiet. Now, that may be a legitimate way to spend money, but it should be legitimized by some kind of popular participation and consent, and it's not. And therefore, the recent trajectory of the Arab world from the 1980s until today, the last 30, 40 years or so, has been a one in which larger and larger numbers of people have become more and more vulnerable in their economic condition, in their environmental assets, water, arable land, reasonably priced food, clean air, in their political rights, in every single Arab country, still today, in every single Arab country, we have a situation where popular consent has not validated the national policy-making and decision-making political structure. We have never had, except in Tunisia, and that only happened last year, we have never had until last year a constitution in an Arab country that was written by the citizens after long public debate about issues that mattered to the citizens. Arabism, Islamism, secularism, Zionism, Western countries' imperial policies, Iran, Russia, the conservative Arab countries, the Western countries, the role of men, the role of women, big important issues that matter to ordinary people had never ever been discussed in a major public way, in a meaningful way, by citizens to come up with a national consensus to therefore create some kind of social compact, social pact between citizens and leaders. It has never happened in the Arab world until Tunisia last year. The consequence of that is that more and more people became alienated from their own societies. More and more people found it increasingly difficult to meet their basic family needs. So that you had a situation in Egypt, for instance, in recent years, according to a recent survey, 65% of all new entrants into the labor market in Egypt, 65% of people who enter into the labor market for the first time, and these are mostly high school dropouts or graduates, and even some university graduates, 65% of them go into the informal sector. What does that mean? It means they clean car windows, they sweep the entrances to buildings, they carry sacks of potatoes, they go around trying to do any little job to get $2 or $3 a day if they can, because they're not qualified to do really anything else. They're not trained to do anything else. And the problem with that is also documented in recent statistics about educational levels, educational attainment levels. And the evidence from testing of primary school and secondary school students, halfway through primary school and halfway through secondary school, universal testing standards of educational outputs, or outcomes they're called, showed that somewhere around 40% on average, 40 to 45% on average of Arab children do not have basic ability to read or to do numeracy, mathematics. In some countries, it goes up to 55%, including some of the oil-rich Gulf countries. 50-55% of their students are unable effectively to read and to do mathematics. And this is a sign of the mediocrity of the public governance system and the public service delivery system. ISIS did not come out of a vacuum. They did not just suddenly appear. They are the consequence of these decades and decades of increasing pressure on people who found no outlet for their grievances, no mechanism to bring about political change, no way even to articulate the concerns that they have as citizens in countries that they felt were not serving them properly. The Arab uprisings, there was two big early warning signs that the Arab world and the Western world missed in previous years. Early warning signs of this accumulating discontent and discomfort that people felt. And this wasn't just discomfort that people were a little bit upset. This is existential fears among families who could not feed their children and who did not have clean running water in their home, who went to a local medical center run by the government and there was no doctor and there was no medicine, and who knew that their children had no chance whatsoever of ever escaping a life of chronic, perpetual, deep poverty, marginalization, vulnerability, voicelessness, hopelessness. People understood that they and their children were stuck in a lifetime of need and of poverty and of hopelessness. And there was two signs, early warning signs, of this. The first was the huge expansion of the Islamist parties and movements starting in the 1970s. The Muslim Brothers, and then you had other movements like Hezbollah and Hamas, which were national resistance movements to Israeli occupation, but also were reactions to mismanagement of domestic authority. You had Salafist movements growing quietly all over the region starting in the 1980s. Then you had Al-Qaeda, and now you have ISIS. These movements that have an Islamist tinge to them and seek directly to challenge or even to change the public order in their countries. These movements have been telling us for 40 years almost, since the 1970s, there is mass dissatisfaction and discomfort in Arab societies, at the middle class and the lower income levels and the poor levels, in the provincial areas outside the capital, where Zain al-Abidin's wife and children never went, where Hosni Mubarak's wife and children never went. They didn't know these places existed. But the second sign, after 30, 40 years of this, the second sign was that in one of these provincial areas, in Sidi Bouzid in rural Tunisia, a young man named Mohammed Mohammed Bouazizi, sorry. Sidi Bouzid, Mohammed Bouazizi set himself on fire. And why did he set himself on fire on December 17, 2010? Because he was one of these informal laborers. He was selling fruits and vegetables on a pushcart. And he would do this so that his brothers and sisters could stay in school and his mother could have her food and stay alive. And he was the bread earner of the family. He was earning maybe $3, $4, $5 a day, but it was just enough to keep them alive. He had no insurance, no pension, no minimum wage, no licensing. He was working totally informally, because that's how 50, 60% of people in places like Egypt and rural Tunisia, that's how they work. And they can be exploited because they're vulnerable. And he was exploited by the local policewoman one day who took his scale away and pushed him, and he couldn't work because he didn't have a scale, so he couldn't sell fruits and vegetables. And he went to the governor's office to complain, and the governor's office told him to go away, there's nobody there to speak to you. Of course there was, but they weren't interested in hearing anything he had to say. So within the span of a few hours, an ordinary rural Tunisian was essentially told by the two official uniformed representatives of his own government, not Israeli colonizers, not American drones, not British jets attacking Iraq, not Russians or Iranians or anybody coming from outside, his own Tunisian government, the police and the governor's office in his town essentially told him, you don't exist, you don't have any rights, you don't have any voice, you don't matter, we don't need to listen to you. Don't bother wasting your time coming here to complain to us. Just go home and get on with your life. Of course, he couldn't. Because if he couldn't sell, he couldn't make money, he had no life. So he set himself on fire. We don't know why. He died. But he was representative of millions and millions of people around the Arab world. The Arab population grew from 60 million in 1930 to 370 million today. Massive population growth. And I don't know how many of those people felt like him, but I would say certainly 200 million understood exactly what he felt. And that's why when he set himself on fire, and the demonstrations broke out immediately in his area. And this is southwest rural Tunisia. And then the police came in, as typically they beat up the demonstrators, and then demonstrations broke out all over Tunisia, thanks partly to social media, to cell phones, and then Jazeera covered it, and it instantly several hundred million people around the Arab world were glued to their TV stations, watching a popular uprising in Tunisia, basically calling for dignity, for social justice, people holding up signs saying, "I want to live." They were out in the streets spontaneously, hundreds of millions of people, sparked by one person's act to show that, in fact, he was not invisible, he was not voiceless, he was not powerless. And Mohamed Bouazizi unleashed the biggest collective mass rebellion in modern world history, I would say, with several hundred million people around the Arab world spontaneously saying, "We understand your pain, and we're with you, and we want the regime to fall." And one regime after another was challenged, and several of them fell. Only the Tunisians succeeded in making a democratic, pluralistic constitutional transition. But the important thing is that mass Arab uprising from 2010 to 2013 was the second huge signal to people in the Arab world and abroad that there was serious problems among the Arab societies. And both of these signals, the 3.5-4 decades of Islamist assertion and challenging regimes, and the mass popular uprising and the overthrow of several regimes, were two critical signs of the discontent in the region, which brought about no significant change, either in the policies of Arab governments or in the policies of international governments that supported the Arab governments. And therefore, when we got to the period in the last 2 or 3 years, the rise of Daesh, of ISIS, should be absolutely no surprise. Because people had reached such a state of desperation that if a small group of people, a few thousand, started with a few hundred, started with one man, Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, Al-Qaeda member, a Jordanian, who came from Afghanistan. He was sent by bin Laden to set up an operation in Iraq. Why could he do that? Because the Americans and the British, in their criminal invasion of Iraq, created a situation of total chaos, no army, no government, and that's the situation that Al-Qaeda can operate in. Al-Qaeda can only operate in situations of ungovernability and chaos. Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi came, set up shop in Iraq, started attacking Shiites to deliberately foment sectarian violence against Shiites, who many Sunnis feel are not real Muslims. Not all Sunnis feel that, but some do. And certainly the Qaeda strand of extremist, racist sentiment looks at Shiites like that. And they started killing them and blowing up their mosques. And we now have active sectarian Shiite Sunni warfare in some places in the Arab world. The vast majority of Shiites and Sunnis in the Arab world live together perfectly comfortably. They intermarry, they have businesses, they go to class, they have football teams together, they're neighbors, they help each other. But there is simultaneously now active ethnic cleansing and violence between Sunnis and Shiites. Is starting now to pop up in Saudi Arabia, again with ISIS blowing up Shiite mosques. The emergence of the Islamic State in the last year, when they set up shop in Raqqa in northern Syria and then expanded into Iraq, they controlled the territory, they declared a caliphate, they attracted more people. So we have a situation now where there is a piece of land controlled by ISIS with... They probably have about 3 or 4 million people who are under their territory. Most of those people don't want them there. but they have no choice. The active members of or supporters of ISIS are not really known to anybody, but I would estimate that we're not talking about more than maybe, I don't know, 50,000, 40, 50,000 people. We have no idea what the real numbers are. And every few months, the CIA or the British intelligence or somebody comes up with a figure. They have 30,000 members. They have 60,000 members. And we have all these figures also now coming of Europeans who go and join ISIS. People from Tunis, from Saudi Arabia, from Pakistan. So there's a lot of discussion, but there's not a lot of verifiable, credible evidence about many, many aspects of ISIS. The key point I would make is that it is ISIS is a reflection of the cumulative disorders, dysfunction, brutality, mediocrity, and amateurism of Arab governance over the last three generations, since the 1970s, I would say. The cumulative accumulation of all of that. Repeatedly, people in the Arab world tried through human rights activism, through democracy activism, through people looking at Islamic movements, looking at the UN Charter, appealing to any possible way to get rid of these dictatorial, brutal regimes and have a more normal life. Nobody listened. Nobody could do anything about it. It built up and built up and built up. The explosion of the uprisings 4 years ago happened. Still, people in the West didn't quite know what to do. Hillary Clinton was wondering about, you know, is Hosni Mubarak an okay guy? We can deal with him. So with a complete reaction of confusion in the Western world and reassertion of autocracy among Arab elites, we have the situation we have in the Arab world today, where only Tunisia has broken through to a democratic state, but ISIS has emerged as the reflection of everything that has been wrong in our countries for years and years, causing a small group of these people to try to create an Islamic state that they feel is in the image of the earliest Islamic state and society of the Prophet, and therefore creates a perfect society where Muslims should come and live and everybody is treated equally in their views. Now, the point that's important about Islamic State or ISIS is that there's about 15 different reasons why people actually go there. There isn't one reason why people support ISIS. And it's simplistic and unrealistic when people in Western countries, especially like President Obama or President Hollande or somebody, says the problem is education, the problem is poverty, the problem is unemployment, the problem is madrasas. There isn't one problem, because there isn't one reason why people join ISIS. People join ISIS sometimes for real serious religious fervor. There is a core group of ISIS who truly believe that creating the perfect Islamic society in the image of the days of the Prophet will solve the problem for all Muslims and will create a new world and will herald the return of the Mahdi and the end of the world, and we'll all go to heaven and we'll be in paradise forever. That's a very small group of people, and you have people in Christianity and Judaism who have exactly the same sentiments. They're very small. You have people who join ISIS because they need $400 a month. There's no other way they can live. You have people who join ISIS because they want to get revenge for the brutal way in which Arab regimes, especially Syrians and Iraqis, treated the Sunni majorities. There's many people who join ISIS because they feel it's the last chance for the Sunnis to protect themselves in a region that's being taken over by Shiites and Iranians and Americans and others. These are reasons they give. I don't agree with most of these, but what I'm trying to do is to analyze what are the many different reasons for the many different kinds of people who join ISIS, to make it clear that there is no one solution. There is no magic bullet that can fix the problem for ISIS. But by understanding these many different reasons, we can then start to understand how do we fix this problem? How do we get out of this mess that we're in? We get out of it by understanding how we got into it. What are the reasons that caused all these different people to join ISIS? What are the reasons that caused mass disenchantment within the Arab world to reach the point where we end up with something so extreme and so brutal as ISIS? You have some people who join ISIS because they're angry at Sykes and Picot. You have some people who join ISIS because they're angry against the Crusades. They don't like the way that Western power has been used against us in the Arab Islamic world, and they want to get even. You have some people who join ISIS because they feel that this is the way that their life has meaning. Directionless, lost young men mostly, who don't know what they want to do in life. Many of us at the age of 18 didn't know what we wanted to do in life. But some people, in the worst cases, go off and find their answer in ISIS. Some people join ISIS because it stops crime in the society where they live. They join ISIS because they're fed up with being stopped 3 times on the road between Damascus and Baghdad by highway robbers or by even policemen who stop them and ask for a bribe. They join ISIS because they feel there is a sense of order and stability in that society. It's a brutal order and stability. But if you're a Muslim who believes in what ISIS is doing and you live in that society, you have order, you have stability, you have a sense of justice, you see everybody is treated equally. It provides a tremendous contrast to the disorder, the dysfunction, the corruption, the favoritism, the abuse of power, the disparity, all of the problems that modern Arab society has suffered. ISIS offers itself as a contrast. And there's many, many other reasons. You have the foreign jihadis who go to join ISIS are one of the most peculiar phenomena. And Anne can tell us more because she deals with this. But the reality of the foreign jihadis, as far as I can tell, based on a lot of reading and talking to people, is that these are people who are deeply troubled in their lives. Some of them are criminal elements. Some of them were in jail where they got radicalized. These are young people who are not sure of their place in society, where they belong in European or American or Australian society, where their families originally come from. They have poor social relationships. They may not have many friends. They have no jobs in many cases. And ISIS is the instant answer. It gives them power. It gives them authority. It gives them meaning. It gives them opportunity. It gives them a job. It gives them everything that they don't have. It gives them a moral order in their life that they lack. They don't get it at home. They don't get it in society. They don't get it in the French parliament. They get it in ISIS. And this is how they see it. Now, these are people who need psychological help more than they need religious training. But they find that psychological help in a group like ISIS. These are people who would have joined a cult or a motorcycle gang 20 years ago. They would have gone to Texas to some nutcase cult or Montana or something in the U.S. where people went and congregated. But now they have the option to join ISIS. And some of these people, they convert to Islam, and the week after that, they go to ISIS. So there's obviously something unusual going on there. These are not lifelong, fervent Muslims seeking to recreate the justice and hope of the Prophet Muhammad. These are people who need help, and they're disillusioned, and they're lost, and they're directionless, and this is what they do. And there's many other reasons. So if we want to fight ISIS, we need to identify the underlying causes of ISIS. And we need to fight ISIS by removing those underlying causes. The problem is that cannot be done quickly. It cannot be done with leaders of many countries, Arab countries, Western countries, marching down a boulevard in central Paris talking about freedom and things like that, which I think are perfectly legitimate in expressing our love for freedom, especially freedom of the press, which I've worked with all my life. But trying to counter ISIS by calling for people to speak out about moderate Islam and to do things of that nature is completely besides the point. Has zero impact on the people who join ISIS, probably even provokes more recruits to join ISIS, because that's the whole point of what ISIS is offering its people, true Islam. But it's not Islam that is the main attraction, in my view. It is all of these other aspects of an orderly life, of a normal life, of a life of purpose, a life of meaning, opportunity, empowerment, etc., etc. The last point, and then I'll stop. We cannot fight ISIS with the same tools that created ISIS. And what I mean by that, ISIS came about as a consequence of two major forces, Arab autocracy and Western militarism, and to an extent, Israeli militarism and colonization. But the Israeli-Palestine issue has a major impact on the region in many ways, but only an indirect impact on the issue of ISIS. But Western militarism, the attack on Iraq, the drones that the Americans now use, and Arab autocracy together were the two forces that cumulatively created the conditions on the ground, especially in Iraq after the 2003 war, and psychologically and politically the conditions in people's minds across the Arab world in the last 30 years to reach this point of desperation where this kind of movement would emerge. And it was in Arab jails in particular, in Morocco, in Jordan, in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, Syria, Iraq, other places. It's in Arab jails that many of the critical key leaders of Al-Qaeda, like Ayman al-Zawahiri, like Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, like Abdullah Azam and many others, they were radicalized in Arab jails, just like many of the ISIS members were radicalized in French jails and Belgian jails and British jails and American jails. Arab jails and Western jet fighters were the two symbolic drivers that created the conditions that gave rise to ISIS. You cannot defeat ISIS by using Arab autocratic regimes and Western military action. You cannot be the midwife of ISIS and then come to the funeral and be the pallbearer of ISIS. You cannot do that. It just is totally contradictory. The same forces of Arab autocracy and Western militarism cannot defeat ISIS after they inadvertently created it. So what I'm saying is the solution to defeating ISIS is understanding those 15 different reasons that cause people to gravitate to ISIS, or if not to join it, to not oppose it. There's hundreds of thousands of people in Mosul and Ramadi and other places in Iraq and Syria that did not oppose ISIS when it came in and took over. They didn't support it, they didn't invite it, but they didn't fight it either. Why? Because they thought ISIS was less bad than the Iraqi regime or the Syrian regime. They thought ISIS was less bad. And that's a terrible verdict on the condition of the Arab regimes. So the solution to defeating ISIS is addressing those conditions that were created by Arab regimes and by their international supporters, foreign governments, from east and west and everywhere. That's a very difficult long-term process. But it can be done. It can be done starting with rhetoric, starting with people speaking out about the issues, starting by people in Sweden, in Europe, in North America, saying that what some of the Arab regimes are doing is unacceptable, against human rights standards, against fundamental decency, against the UN Charter, against the fundamentals of all of the Abrahamic faiths, putting 40,000 people in jail, as Sisi has done in Egypt, is totally unacceptable. It cannot be possibly accepted by anybody. So people need to start addressing those issues if they want to see ISIS disappear. If we only defeat them militarily, which is doable, once you get ground forces and air forces working together, they will be defeated. But if you don't address those underlying causes, we'll get something worse than ISIS a few years down the road. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really a comprehensive response to the question of how could ISIS emerge in the situation as it is.
Turn on the mic. There you go.
One issue that has been discussed here quite a lot is the impact of the American invasion in Iraq on the development of ISIS. Some of those who are leading now the ISIS military operations are actually either coming directly from U.S. administered prisons in Iraq, or were among those who were quickly dismissed by the US forces when they arrived and went into hiding, but they kept the military competence that they had developed under Saddam Hussein. To what extent is this picture correct, and to what extent is it relevant for the military successes so far of ISIS?
Well, from everything that I read, and especially everything that I read by people who I trust who are really knowledgeable about ISIS, who have done serious research, and which is the only way we can really know about them, because it's, you can't go there and interview them very easily. It seems that there's a significant role being played by former Ba'athist officers in Iraq. Not because they believe in the Islamic State, but it's interesting, in the last few years of Saddam Hussein's reign, he became increasingly Islamist. He used Islam as a form of popular legitimacy. And therefore, there were people who were in the Ba'athist Party who were also very Islamist in their political and ideological sentiments. Some of them did gravitate clearly to ISIS. And there are Iraqis, especially at the military level, of ISIS, and there's very good books that have been written about this with names of people if you want more information that's easily available. So there is that element, but these are former Ba'athists who are joining ISIS mainly because they want to get back into power in Baghdad, I think, not because they want to live in a perfect Islamic society. And there may be some of them who are very religiously motivated, but the majority, I think, they just want revenge against the Americans for destroying the Ba'athist regime, and they want to regain power.
Okay.
Another question I had was that when you explained that there were many varied different reasons why people joined the ISIS, some rather ideological and fundamentalist of nature, and others of other character. That raises the question of how strong is the movement socially, and I assume that after some time, when they have governed an area,
when they have what?
They've been in command of an area, the various different motives for people to join and support may begin to show some cracks. So far, have we seen any tendency that people who accepted them or even welcomed them, they begin to be skeptical, and that there is a sort of a growing dissatisfaction with the kind of rule that they have imposed. Would that be of any significance for the future development?
It's a very mixed picture. The first thing that you need to keep in mind is in an area like Raqqa or Mosul in northern Syria and northern Iraq, people living there have experienced foreign invaders coming in and ruling them for a while and then leaving for about 6,000 years. Approximately 6,000 years, people there have experienced this process. And they could be Mughals or Byzantines or Romans or Arabs out of the desert and people from the north and Genghis Khan and all kinds of military conquest movements have come in, ruled, and left. So people have learned over time that if you don't want to get your head chopped off, then you just lie low, let the invaders come in, play by the rules, and usually if you play by the rules, they're not going to chop your head off. If you just don't aggravate them, antagonize them, and people wait and see what happens. Now, two things tend to happen. Historically, what happens is that most of the foreign invaders who come to the region and stay for a while mix with the local population and adapt to the conditions in the region, and they intermarry and they start having names from local people. If you go to the Roman theater in Jerash in central Jordan from the second century A.D. Under Trajan, and you look at the Roman theater, you find that the Roman theater, which was a city council chamber where people met to discuss municipal affairs, the city council chamber in Roman times had the names of local tribes. In other words, the local tribal reality that defined life in that Arab region imposed itself on the imported Roman system of a city council that included usually nobility and rich merchants and representatives of the emperor and whatever. So the people living under ISIS, I believe, basically are lying low. Most of them don't want ISIS, but they can't do anything about it. They wait and see what happens. ISIS also has to learn to interact with the local people. They're the government. They have to deliver. What's the first thing ISIS does when it goes into an area? It makes sure that the bakeries have flour, that there's bread every day. What's the second thing they do? They try to make sure that electricity is running. Third thing they do, order in the streets. No more people asking ransom or holding up, robbing people or threatening people or kidnapping people. Fourth thing they do, they set up courts, Islamic courts, and they immediately adjudicate disputes between tribal leaders, between families, between merchants. And that's, in fact, how they tend to develop their credibility before they move into an area. They present themselves as the purveyors of justice, not just justice, God's divine justice, as given to humankind through the Prophet Muhammad. And this is a message that rings loud and clear in the eyes of local people who have only experienced injustice and abuse of power. So the ISIS adapts to the fact that they are in charge. They have to deliver. And for the moment, they've been able to more or less keep things moving. Their problem is that the population under their control has expanded. The cost of running an administration has expanded. People who've studied this that I've talked to estimate that ISIS needs something like $100 to $150 million a month to administer the caliphate, as they call it, their state. The army, the defense, the civil service, the people they hire, etc., etc. And their sources of income have been badly hit by the bombings, mostly knocking out the refineries that reduces their oil income, by reducing trade and by other things that have been hurt by the bombing. Therefore, their income now is estimated to be $50-60 million a month as opposed to their needs of 100 to 150. Those are estimates. Who knows how accurate they are, but they're done by very serious people who've done these studies. So clearly they are under pressure. There's areas now where there's no electricity under ISIS because the power system has been cut because of bombing, and if you don't, they can't deliver electricity. There's areas where there's where the fundamental services like transport have been disrupted, so trade is disrupted. So they're starting to feel pressures of administration, both because of the bombings, but also because of their inability to manage such a large area, which makes me think that ISIS's strategy probably is not to keep expanding, but to contract a little bit, to consolidate its territory, and try to run a society that they think might attract other people. They want to attract Muslims from all over the world to live in this perfect Muslim society, Islamic society, in their view. They have to make sure that it's a society that is appealing to people. And I think this is going to be their focus right now, is to manage the area they have more efficiently so that people are not grumbling and complaining. We know from many anecdotal stories that people have tried to leave, but they can't because they killed them. And many Western recruits who went to ISIS who tried to leave couldn't because they'll get killed. So there's clear tension. And this is a society run by intimidation primarily. As I said, there's a core of real, true believers, but the majority of people who join ISIS are not joining it because they think it's a perfect Islamic society. They're joining it for other personal reasons, economic reasons, historical reasons, ideological reasons, whatever.
But if the American bombings create economic problems of the kind you mentioned, would that give the leadership of ISIS the possibility to blame the problems on the Americans and thereby sort of ideologically convince people that we are surrounded by enemies and we have to stick together, so that they could use the problems by sort of strengthening their anti-American approach?
Yes, I think some ISIS leaders would definitely try to do that. Arab leaders do that all the time. They blame foreigners for their problems, and so people in Lebanon blame Iran, people in Syria blame Saudi Arabia, people in Palestine blame the U.S., people everywhere blame Israel. I mean, people are constantly blaming people outside for their problems. But ordinary citizens are not stupid. They know what the causes of their problems really are. So I think ISIS is in trouble. I think it's a troubled movement that created a splash for the reasons that I mentioned. The main reason for ISIS's success is the derelict, incompetent nature of the Syrian and the Iraqi army and government. No question in my mind. Why didn't ISIS expand in Jordan or in Morocco or in Kuwait? It expanded in Syria and Iraq, where you had the most brutal police states, where you had the most dysfunctional security systems, and that was the only place that they were able to expand. So I think there are serious signs of trouble for ISIS, and how they react is going to be interesting. The more interesting thing, in my view, is the emergence of other Islamist movements in Syria, like Jabhat al-Nusra, like Jaish al-Fateh, and there's many, many other serious movements that are opposing the Assad government, that use military force successfully, that also try to organize society, that are less extremist and violent than ISIS. So there's going to be a fascinating competition in the next 6 months or a year between ISIS and Nusra and Jaish al-Fateh and other groups, to see who becomes the most credible force. And the final arbiter is going to be the reaction of the local populations to these groups. Whichever of these groups is able to gain the credibility or the allegiance of local populations will be the dominant one. And I don't rule out the possibility that some of these movements, I don't think ISIS, but I think others, will become more pragmatic. That some of them will say, we want to govern an Islamic emirate or state, and to do that, we're willing to tone down our extremist behavior. So Nusra, for instance, doesn't cut people's heads off and put them on TV, like ISIS does, because they understood that that repels people. So it's not out of the question that some of these extremist groups might moderate, not so much moderate, but become more pragmatic in how they selectively implement their principles for the benefit of not alienating local populations and therefore getting a degree of credibility and even legitimacy. It's possible. I don't rule it out, but I don't think so, because what these people are doing is so alien to the fundamental values of most Arabs and Muslims in the Arab world. And anybody who knows the region, as you do, and many of you do, will know that what these people are offering is not what ordinary Arabs want. The overwhelming majority of Arabs and Muslims think these people are criminals, but they can't do anything about them. The overwhelming majority of Arabs thought that their own regimes were acting in a criminal way, in a dictatorial way, in an unjust way, in a brutal way, but they couldn't do anything about them. So this is the great painful dilemma of the modern Arab world, that 370 million Arab citizens are more or less helpless in the face of the powers that control them. But they're not totally helpless, because some of them have now joined some of these Islamist rebellion groups, like ISIS, like Nusra, like others. So there is a change going on, and we don't know where it's going to end up, but there's change and movement happening, and people are not going to be silent forever. But for the moment, ISIS and Nusra and these groups are the ones who dominate, because they're the best armed, They're the best trained, and they're the most willing to go and fight and achieve their goals, which originally were to overthrow Assad in Syria, but now have been expanded to creating an Islamic State.
If I may add one aspect which you haven't touched upon so far, and that's the skills that ISIL shows when it comes to social media. They are pretty unique compared to the other terror organizations in the level of multilingual messaging, unlike Al-Qaeda, very much concentrating in Arabic, but here we see in Somali, Swedish, British English, etc., etc. And I think that's one of several reasons why it really is appealing to many youngsters to join. Mm. And it's interesting to see also that it's very rare that one is getting radicalized solely on internet or by sitting in front of your computer. It usually needs another step in that process. But it's very often the beginning of this radicalization, whether it's inside the Arab world or in Europe.
Right. That's true. And in this case, again, social media, like in the case of the explosion of the Arab revolutions and uprisings, I remember back in February 2011, at the height of the Arab revolutions in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, many people in the West were saying, mistakenly, I thought, this is the Twitter revolution, this is the Facebook revolution, because they saw the role of social media in spreading information, in mobilizing people and doing things, in giving voice to people who were voiceless. But in retrospect, the social media were a tool that were used by people who had the courage and the determination to challenge their regimes. And in the similar situation, social media for ISIS is a tool that it uses to reach people who are susceptible to the message that it sends. If ISIS came into this room and were given a platform to speak, I don't think many of you, or none of you possibly, or maybe one or two of you might convert and join them. But most of you wouldn't, because you're not susceptible to that kind of message. Who are the people that ISIS reaches with its social media or its recruiters? And I think you've caught a couple of them today and yesterday. People were arrested here for recruiting. It's these lost young kids, these teenagers, 18, 20, 24-year-old, mostly young men, who are lost and aimless and detached. The great French scholar Olivier Roy calls them deterritorialized Muslims, deterritorialized. They don't belong to a territory. So they'll go fight in Bosnia, they'll go fight in Chechnya, they'll go fight in the Philippines, they'll go Afghanistan, Iraq, and if tomorrow there's an uprising in California for Muslims, they'll go fight. These are young people who are completely lost in the world. And they are susceptible to a social media campaign that promises them power, prestige, authority, purpose, impact, friendship, solidarity, a job, several wives, a home, a Toyota, and you can ride around in a Jeep and shoot people and be jihadi cool. And this is incredible. And this is all this combination of these things is what actually succeeds. Not all of these reasons attract one person, but all of these reasons attract different people. And therefore, the social media are the tool that is used successfully, but they're successful because the environment of these lost souls is a receptive environment. It's important to understand that. So you have an issue in the Western world of political integration, prison management, because many of these people are radicalized in prisons, especially in France and in England, and assimilation. And these are issues that you've dealt with in Europe for many years, some places successfully, some places less successfully. It's a big, big challenge. And that's why people today are more concerned about accepting thousands and thousands of more immigrants. If these immigrants are going to come here and then they're going to get radicalized, they're going to go to ISIS and then come back and blow up your supermarkets, then, you know, thank you, but no thank you. It's understandable that people would react against this. But it is a problem of integration, assimilation, prison management, and youth employment. These are all, each one of these is very different, but together they are the basket of issues that need to be dealt with purely in a Western context. The link to ISIS is fascinating, but I think it's quite peripheral, because if it's not ISIS, it's something else that they might, these guys might have gone and joined the Bader-Meinhof gang 40 years ago. But today it's ISIS.
Why not?
Do we have comments and questions?
Yeah, let's go more democratic. Can everyone who wants at this stage to ask a question raise their hand so you could see roughly? Okay.
Maybe we should take three or four, and I'll give quick answers.
Yeah. Please.
Yeah, my name is Jan Furnesson. What's the role of Iran and Saudi Arabia and the question of proxy war? Just Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
First, I want to thank you very much for an excellent presentation and analysis of an extremely complex problem.
I was inspired by Thomas and Anne here. They get a lot of credit.
My question in this way, having listened to your analysis, it's of course very difficult to draw a conclusion to what a European government, including the Swedish, could do. Because you say, if I understand you rightly, it's not through military means. And by the way, I guess you're not very impressed with what the coalition in Paris yesterday agreed upon. But so it's not a military. It's probably not aid or whatever we call it, because that will go to the corrupt regimes, which will do it differently. It's not a political, so to say, exporting democracy, because this is coming from below. So what is your advice to a European government what to do?
Okay, let's take one more. And then
That sounded like a rather basic question here. Racket.
If you go outside the Arab world and look at Indonesia, for instance, other Muslim countries outside the Arab in Indonesia, for instance, does it have any impact on Indonesia, the ISIS movement?
Okay.
Okay.
I think we take those now, and because we will forget
them later. Let me answer those. Iran and Saudi Arabia, there is a problem between them. It's a problem that is, I believe, mostly in the mind of Saudi leaders rather than a genuine geostrategic mutual threat. The Saudis, and now their GCC partners, see the Iranians as a hegemonic predatory threat in the region. They say that they're meddling in Iraq and in Syria and in Lebanon and now in Yemen and Bahrain. They're using Shiite Arab minorities to push their interests. I don't believe that's actually fully correct. I think that's a vast exaggeration. The reality is that Iran has many things that we can criticize it for, absolutely. Human rights, the way they deal with their limited pluralistic system. There's many, many things that we can criticize Iran for. But I don't believe they're a hegemonic power. I believe they're a regional power, like Turkey, like Israel, like Saudi Arabia, that has genuine, legitimate interests in the region and is much more successful than the Saudis at actually following its interests and developing strategic relationships with people around the Arab world, some of whom are Shiites, some of whom are not. I mean, the relationship between Iran and Hamas, for instance. Thank you. So the idea of this Shiite Persian wave of threats against the Arab world that the Saudis are reacting to the point where they went and invaded Yemen, which I think is one of the most bizarre political moves in the last century, to me is just vastly exaggerated and not grounded in reality. I think the Saudis are immature in their regional politics. I think they don't know how to respond to the more nuanced and effective Iranian diplomacy. And what they need to do is to sit down, if those of you who are old enough to remember the Helsinki Accords here in Europe, to sit down and have an Helsinki-like arrangement in the region where the Turks, the Iranians, the Saudis, the Egyptians, The Israelis can't be part of it now, but one day later. But the powers of the region have to sit down and work out an arrangement for the security of the region where they don't invade each other and do regime change, but they allow normal trade and
the question was related to ISIS. Do the Saudis prefer ISIS take on the Iran and the Shia domination? That was my idea.
The evidence suggests that Saudi Arabia and people in the Gulf, whether they're governments or friends of governments or cousins of governments or neighbors of governments, we don't know, but people in the Gulf have been sending aid to some Islamist extremist groups, including some who are in ISIS. The direct linkages are not proven in any way that I've seen, but clearly there is something going on there between the Wahhabi Saudi tradition, which is very similar to ISIS. You know, the expansion of the Islamic State and the birth of Saudi Arabia are almost identical phenomena historically. Saudi Arabia was formed, several Saudi republics or several Saudi kingdoms were formed over the last 300 years by the same things that ISIS has done, by armed groups of raiders going out and conquering territory and creating a state which is heavily Islamic. The Wahhabi tradition is a very extreme form of Islam. And they're promoting this extreme form of Islam across the region and across the world for the last 40 years or so. So there is clearly something. I don't think Saudi Arabia would want ISIS to succeed as an Islamic state, because ISIS actually is the aim of ISIS is to replace the Sunni theological legitimacy of Saudi Arabia. There's two targets for the Islamic State in theological and political leadership terms, Al-Azhar in Egypt and the Saudi regime. The ISIS people are saying, like Al-Qaeda said, these Arabs are not real Muslims. They let American soldiers and girls in shorts, and they let women drive, and they drink alcohol, and they gamble, and they do all these things that are un-Islamic. And so Al-Qaeda challenged the Arab regimes, but never tried to create a caliphate. These guys have. And the aim of ISIS is to be the reference point for Muslims all over the world, which is totally unachievable, I believe. So the Saudis could not possibly benefit from ISIS expanding, but maybe they think they can use it in the short run to scare the Syrian government, scare the Iraqi government, scare the Iranians. But this is, again, a sign of the amateur, incompetent manner of Saudi statecraft. I think the Saudis are not very good at statecraft. They just haven't done it very much. And suddenly they burst out and they have war. Now you can see they're doing erratic things, but it's their coming out into this world stage. And the Saudis are now serious players across the region. The European response, there is, as I said, there's no easy, quick one answer to this problem, but I believe the answer has to be to analyze and understand ISIS for what it really is in a more accurate way than we misunderstood and wrongly analyzed Al-Qaeda when it started 25 years ago. If you look at Al-Qaeda today, they're much stronger, much bigger, and they gave birth to ISIS. I mean, ISIS is a stepchild of Al-Qaeda. So the misdiagnosis of Al-Qaeda, mainly by the Americans, but also by the Europeans, and the misdiagnosis of extremist, Islamist, militant movements by the Western world led to policies that were total failures, which heavily relied on military attacks and relied on childish policies like the British government's policy of going out and trying to talk to Muslims and say, you know, we love Islam and, you know, the Quran is a book of peace. And where are the moderate Muslim voices? This is all good stuff, you know, it's all true. But it's nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, has nothing to do with ISIS. So this idea that you need to promote a more moderate voices of Islam, which Arab leaders and Western leaders are saying, is totally misses the point. It's a complete waste of time if you're trying to fight ISIS. You should promote moderate Islam, and you should promote moderate Christianity in the White House before attacking Iraq as well, and in Tony Blair's office before attacking Iraq. We need more moderate Christianity. We certainly need more moderate Judaism and Zionism in Israel before continuing to colonize and bomb Arab countries. So moderation is something that all the Abrahamic faiths would benefit from, absolutely. So the response has to be to analyze and understand ISIS and the conditions that led to its emergence in a more accurate way, and to put the pieces together in a more accurate way. So economic need, environmental stress, political autocracy, social extremism, etc., all the different things that I mentioned, and then to start addressing them. The first, and that's not easy. The first thing you have to do is you address them at the level of rhetoric. And you address, that means it's not your responsibility to defeat ISIS. It's the Arab world's responsibility to defeat them. And ISIS is an Arab problem. It's not an Islamic or a Middle Eastern problem. It's an Arab problem. It's about the abuse of Arab power, the misuse of Arab sovereignty. But the first step, I believe, the critical thing, as I said before, I think I said, I'm not sure if I said it clearly, the critical dynamic in this whole process of citizens over the last 40 years becoming hopeless and radicalized and et cetera, is at what point does an average citizen in Morocco or Kuwait or Lebanon or Syria, at what point does a normal, peace-loving, law-abiding citizen, poor, middle-class, rich, doesn't matter, at what point does that citizen become radicalized? What is the tipping point that causes people to join these extremist movements, or at least causes people in Mosul to not resist when ISIS comes in? What's going on in the minds of people? It's the sense that they have no hope of a better life under the present Arab autocratic conditions. So therefore, I think the critical first step has to be, and this is a role that foreign parties can play. And if you're giving hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars in aid to Arab countries, the first thing I think you should absolutely do is ask President Sisi, why does he have 40,000 people in jail who are mostly prisoners of conscience, who are mostly young activists or Muslim brother members who have mostly, there's a few of them who killed people and should be in jail if they're given a fair trial, which is difficult in Egypt today. But so you can go to a place like Egypt or the Gulf countries where they're taking citizenship away from citizens because they tweeted something that's critical of the regime. I mean, this is so egregious, so extreme behavior on the part of sovereign governments. Sovereign governments that are building, American universities and British universities and importing the Louvre and doing all these and paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to Tony Blair to come and give a speech and building Formula One track races and tennis matches that are trying to buy legitimacy from copying the Western world. You have the role and the responsibility to go to those governments and say, you cannot put 40,000 people in jail, if you're people, and expect us to support you. That at some point you need to make it clear that you oppose what they're doing on moral and political and legal grounds. If Arab citizens start to understand that the criminal behavior of their regimes is in fact not supported by foreign countries, it could have a significant impact by making people have a sense of hope, which they don't have now. At some point, there will be an Arab Gorbachev. There will be an Arab F.W. de Klerk. Somebody in authority who understands that this system is not sustainable, that they should change the system before the system changes them. We have our freedom fighters. We have people who have fought bravely for democracy and freedom of speech and all these things, but we haven't had the people who've been able to do, let's say, what Solidarity and Lech Walesa did, which has mobilized tens of millions of people for a peaceful transition to democratic rule. So the role of European governments, I think, is to first articulate clearly what is right and what is wrong. And if a foreign minister of a European unnamed country criticizes the Saudis, well, the Saudis deserve it. And I think the foreign ministers of unnamed European countries should clearly articulate what is being done by Arab regimes that is totally against international standards. It's not your job to punish them, but it is your job to affirm what you stand for and how you will help them. And the last point here, the most important thing that you can do now is massively help Tunisia to succeed as a democratic, pluralistic, constitutional, republican, tolerant, law-abiding country with a growing economy. If Tunisia, the example of Tunisia grows, Tunisia should be to the Arab world what Poland was to Europe. The Polish movement in solidarity in 1980, 10 years later, brought down the whole Soviet Union. And Tunisia can be the same for the Arab world. So help Tunisia and speak out why you're helping Tunisia and why you're not helping Morocco or Jordan or Bahrain or some or Saudi Arabia or somewhere else, because they don't have these same standards. Indonesia, the small numbers of people are coming from many countries. Indonesia is one of the best examples of what people would call moderate Islam. The democratic transition in Indonesia over the last 15, 20 years has been quite spectacular, I think, quite peaceful with the economy that's developing. But there's always individuals coming from these countries, but they're very small numbers. So I wouldn't worry about that too much.
Thank you. Thank you for the push for human rights policy and support to Tunisia.